Lieutenant Savick likes to quote regulations. Khan remembers Chekhov. And James T. Kirk is allergic to Retinax. Hello, everybody, and welcome to The Seventh Rule with Siroc Lofton and Walter Koenig.
Hi, guys.
Hello. Hey,
My
hello.
name is Ryan T. Husk, and today we're doing a very special review of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, story by Harvey Bennett and Jack B. Sowards, teleplay by Jack B. Sowards, a couple uncredited credits, Nicholas Meyer, screenplay, and Samuel A. Peoples, uncredited for a story by credit. This is directed by Nicholas Meyer. This was June 4th, 1982. Where were you? How are you guys doing today?
Doing great.
Wonder if you remember where you were, Ciroc, in 1982. All right.
Yeah.
So, in the show open, everybody, please make sure to check out this pod crawl. The Greatest Generation is doing a pod crawl. That's seven podcasts doing seven Star Trek original series movies because they are celebrating 9 years today. 9 years their podcast has been going on. We will be doing, let's see, here's the order. The Greatest Generation is doing the motion picture. The Seventh Rule, that's us, is doing the Wrath of Khan. Star Trek III, The Search for Spock by Open Pike Night. Star Trek IV, The Voyage Home by The Sci-Fi Sisters, Star Trek V, The Final Frontier by our pals Mission Log, Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country by Women at Warp, and Star Trek The Next Generation, sorry, Star Trek Generations, the movie with the crossover from The Next Generation, that is with The Next Conversation. And they are raising money for the NCSE, the National Center for Science Education promotes and defends accurate and effective science education because everyone deserves to engage with evidence. All right, with that out of the way, and we'll talk a bit more about that a little later. But, Ciroc, was this your first time ever seeing Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan?
No, I've
Ooh.
seen it before, but I was so young that I don't remember anything. I didn't remember a single thing. The only thing I remember from this movie was the ear scene, the bug in the ear, and that because that basically burned into my mind and scarred me mentally for a long time. But that's the only thing I remember from this movie. I also remember the feeling of, seeing Ricardo Montalban and thinking that he was a great actor. That was all I remember as a child. That's the impression that was left on me. And also a little bit of those uniforms, the high collar, very decorative, jackets. And I thought those were also seared in my brain. So other than that, I have no idea about the story. I don't remember anything that happened in the dialogue. So this was new to me in that sense.
Walter, you clearly acted and participated in this movie over 40 years ago. Did you ever watch the movie outside of maybe going to the premiere 40 years ago? Had you ever gone back and revisited it?
I don't remember. I must have seen it at least once beyond the initial screening. But boy, I really enjoyed it. I really thought, watching it again, I really thought this was a really, really good movie. I remember when I read the script initially,
Okay.
and I saw how everything was tied together and the conflicts and the character development. And I said to myself, this is going to be a success. I know you have only my word for that, but that's absolutely the way I felt. I said, this is classic storytelling, beautifully written. The way it evolved, the climax to the story, everything was just, it was grade A storytelling. And I was tickled to get to watch it again.
My memory is similar to Ciroc's. I remember as a very young tyke watching this, and like everybody else, I feel like Melissa said the same thing, and everybody said the same kind of thing, which is all I remember is that thing going in somebody's ear, And that did not look like something I wanted to participate in. And I remember Khan a little bit and the uniforms, of course. And you know, there are a couple images that, you know, I remember. And then I watched several years back. I watched like the first 40 minutes. Just, you know, off the cuff, just watched the first 40 minutes. So that's it. So I kind of was excited about this because I'm like, I can kind of go in fresh face. I know the story. We all know the story a thousand times over, you know, especially in Star Trek fandom. It's all been spoken of. I know all the characters, I know all about it. But a lot of this, I could kind of go in and just enjoy it for feeling like the first time. And the first thing I noticed was in the opening credits, it gave me a bit of nostalgia. I was like, wow, the way they're just the music blasts and you see the opening credits. Nowadays, everything has to just go in immediately and like, oh, this happened, this person died, mystery, explosions, because they got to grab your attention. But back then, you get your Coke, you get your popcorn, you sit down. And you're a captive audience, and then you soak in the opening credits, the opening theme song. You get excited with your, oh, this person's in the movie. And it really had this big feel to it. It made it feel like this is not a Star Trek episode. You're watching a big screen movie. Do you guys remember your first impressions watching this?
Well, I was really excited. I thought everything that I had hoped for was there. It was just so extraordinarily well done. Ricardo Montalban was a little bit, more than most of us are in real life, but I was totally comfortable with his performance. It was like the fact that he was so intense and so passionate said to me, "This is what's happened to him," and I believed it. I didn't think of it as, well, this is just a tour de force performance by an accomplished actor. This was a man living that role in very disproportionately large terms. I bought it. I just bought who he was, and everything he did. It was just the life of the sea. And on top of that, which is the reason why you have me here, is I can give you some insight into the people who we work with. And
Yeah, please.
he was a gentleman through and through and through. Yes, that was his chest. And I found it amazing, and he was a man. He must have been close to 60 at the time, if not even more. But he had an extraordinary build, and he was a delight to work with. One of my favorite stories is the very first day we were on the sound stage. We did a table reading, and then we retired to the to his office, and all of us. And Nick said was starting to tell us about what we needed to do and how we should go about it. And he said, "Ricardo, I got to tell you something. It's a little big. What you're doing is a little." And I said to myself, "Oh my God. Oh my God, this is going to be dreadful." And Ricardo looked at him and said, "I see what you mean. Holy cow. Movie star, 33-year-old Nick Meyer, the director." And he just listened, absorbed it, and made it part of his world. And I thought that was terrific. I said, "This is a real guy that you'd love to hang out with if you knew him."
So Nick Meyer told him to make sure to make it big. He
No,
wasn't
no,
saying,
no, no, no.
or he was
He
telling him
said,
what his performance
"It is a
was
little
already.
big.
Got it.
Bring it down."
Did he bring
I
it
don't
down though?
think he ever did, but what he did do was terrific. I
Yeah.
thoroughly enjoyed it. I didn't cringe. I didn't. I mean, I've seen over-the-top performances, and I've shuddered watching them, but not with Ricardo. I just loved what he did.
Yeah, I agree with that. I thought it was appropriate level of drama, and his presence was big, and I believed every second of what he was, of his performance as well. It did look like he was in charge, and he had a grudge to, you know, he had a bone to pick. He had a grudge he was holding on to. All of those things were well communicated. I was really, I was surprised how integral your part was into this movie, because I didn't realize you played a major role in this particular story in this movie. And I was thoroughly pleased with your performance as well, Walter. There were moments there, for example, when Ricardo was doing his performance and you were listening. I think some of the best acting is done when you don't have any lines and when you're just listening and having to react to other people's words. And I enjoyed watching your facial expressions, which I was closely observing, because it, you did have the feeling and the sense of both the fear of this guy and his, you know, his wrath, which you understood to be a definite threat, but you also stood up to him with the level of, you know, integrity. Like, you know, I'm not going to bow down and shake, you know, and in fear from you. I'm going to still stand here with presence. I wanted to ask you though about Paul Winfield, if you could say a little bit about him and his performance and working with him, because I you know, I thought he was great as well.
Actually, I had met Paul prior to Star Trek. My wife was working at City College in the costume department, and she was working with somebody who was associated with that department, and we ended up going on a double date. And we weren't married at the time, Judy and I, and Paul and Connie. And he was quiet. He was not a, you know, he was not an effusively emotional person, but we got along fine. We got along fine on the set too. We had a moment when I had to correct him, and it ended up in a bet. We were talking about Mutt and Jeff, the comic cartoon characters, and he was sure that my character was Mutt and his was Jeff, because I was the shorter guy, I guess, and I had to explain to him from my superior knowledge of comics. The other way around. We had a $50 bet.
And wow.
I brought in the evidence, and he started to dig for his wallet, and I said, forget it. And he says, well, I will. Are we gone? No. Yeah. This is Mutt, and this is Jeff. So then, that was great. How did you do that? I mean, that's amazing.
Well, at first, anyway, I have a confession to make, Walter. At first, I thought you meant Mutton Jeff, like a lamb and Jeff. So I misspelled it first, but I was like, no, it's probably two names. And so I didn't do it as quickly as I'd like. Sorry.
But he says, well, how about if I contribute? And we mentioned a charity. And I said, that's fine. So that's what we did. That's what he did. He gave it to a charity. So we got along fine. He was kind of quiet, reserved, not distant, just reserved. And it was a good experience. I had a good time working with him.
You know, Sirach and I just recently reviewed a Next Generation episode in which he played Captain Dathan in the episode Darmok, and we were just blown away by how great his acting was. So I was really excited. I was like, wow, we get to do some back-to-back Paul Winfield real quick. That was really cool. He was amazing as Darmok. I thought he was great in this, and I was really excited to see his face and to kind of watch him act without the makeup. But what were you saying, Sirach?
Yeah, I kind of had a follow-up question about Mutt and Jeff, and I wanted to know what were the characteristics of those characters that you thought reflected into the Star Trek characters that you were playing. What? Why did you have this debate about who was Mutt and Jeff Do you remember if it was about your characters? You
Well, he
know.
was commenting about that you know, he was Jeff and I was Mutt, you know, big and short guy. And
Right.
I just corrected him because I have my superior knowledge about comics.
So it's the
Oh, so the
physicality of it.
height. It was just about the height.
It was a very intellectual conversation, as you can
Okay. Who's the tall one? Mutt or
imagine.
Jeff?
Jeff, I mean, Mutt is the tall one.
Okay, so
Okay.
Ciroc is Mutt and I'm Jeff, basically, is what we're talking about here. All
You
right.
mentioned Nicholas Meyer being 33 years old, and you know that's pretty young to be directing a cast with this level of maturity. What was that like, and what was the experience like working with him?
Well, that's interesting. I don't, when I said 33, I don't know how old he was, actually.
No.
I do know something. He came in one day very excited, holding a book that I had written. And it turns out that we had gone to the same high school, 10 years apart. He
Wow.
was 10 years after me. We'd gone to a private high school in New York called Fieldston.
Yeah.
And that same high school that J. Robert Oppenheimer went to, by the way. Not that we were necessarily in the same category as Jeff. But and then the guy who became the second in command at Disney and then came over to Paramount, he came 10 years after the two, after Nick. So there was three generations. I can't think of his name. Epstein, Weinstein, somethingstein.
Yeah.
Small guy with glasses. I'm sure you know who I mean if I could remember. But anyway, so we had that in common. We had Fieldston High School in common, which was kind of interesting.
Do you remember,
Wow.
Walter, when you guys are first getting the band back together? By the way, he was in his mid-30s, like 35, 36 when you were shooting this. And Montalban was 62 when the movie premiered, so he was like 60,
Whoa.
six, he was 60, 61.
Whoa.
You're right on with that when you guys were shooting. Do you remember those first days of coming together again after, you know, a few years after the motion picture and thinking like, was there a lot of optimism? Was there a big buzz going around? Was it business as usual? Do you remember those initial days?
Not really. I mean, I felt great. First of all, I had something to do in the town.
Right.
And I had this feeling, having read their screenplay, that this was going to be a successful picture. I really was enthusiastic about it. Nick was great. I'd like to take this moment, if I may, to announce for Nick's benefit. I had issues with Bill. Bill, I thought, was terrific, by the way, but I had issues with him, as did the other supporting actors, with him overwhelming the soundstage, overwhelming each scene, being not as selfless as he might have been regarding the other actors. He did an amazing job. I thought he was terrific playing the role of Kirk. But it could be inferred that in my saying that he was overwhelming the show, the set, and actually taking away moments from the other actors, that I am in some way criticizing the director for not being able to take control. Well, I never mentioned, whenever I complained about Bill, I never mentioned Nick. Because it was just impossible. You know, very few directors, certainly not, never in television, but even in the motion pictures, if you have a major star as your lead, there's going to be deferral on the part of the director. And Nick was just not in a position to say to Bill, no, let's do it the way that I saw it immediately, the way I first saw it. He just wasn't in the position. And I didn't make that a point of my criticism, and I should have, because it wasn't Nick's fault. You know, unless you were Robert Wise, you know, and had that huge history, you're not in a position to countermand your movie star's point of view.
Yeah.
So just wanted to make that true. And I'm so tickled and pleased that they conferred on this movie. I'm sure we were going to talk about it anyway, but then conferred on this movie a very special designation. I can't think of the name of the group that takes, was it 10 or 20 movies a year and assigns them to a special category historically.
Yeah, the National Archive, I think, is what it, yeah. This movie was recently inducted into the National Archive, if I'm not mistaken. That's what you're referring to, Walter?
Yes, and that's a great honor. And they gave the award to Nick. They acknowledged him as the director, as well as they should. He you know, I think he did a great job. Bill Shatner's control notwithstanding.
Walter, can we talk a little bit? We've got a few minutes left in this segment. You mentioned Bill Shatner, heard of him. You said he did great in his performance. And then you've always been really good about separating personal feelings with objective interpretation, or, you know, giving out of accolades. What was it about Bill Shatner's performance that you liked? Were there certain moments or scenes, or just the whole gravitas of it all?
I liked the whole thing. I just think he did a terrific job. You know, people, there are people, and they may, I'm sure they're in the minority, who will say that there was overacting being done. When he yells, "Con!" I think that's an investment of character and an emotion. I don't think that was overacting. I think it was appropriate for the moment. It was incredibly, you know, intense time in the story, and I think Bill was exceptionally good in this film in every way. Even the little moment when he had in the elevator with Savick, and he's sort of flirting with her a little bit. I thought that was a touching moment. And very appropriate. You know, I wonder, when I was watching this movie, I was thinking, what do people who don't have no idea about Star Trek, who have never seen it, when they watch this film, what are they going through? What are they thinking? The way the characters were evolved and developed and how they related to each other. This was not ordinary filmmaking. Not to me, it wasn't. It was very personal. The way it was done was just so dimensional and personal. And I thought everybody did a bang up job. I think Kirstie, in that very first scene where she's sitting in the captain's chair and giving direction, I didn't think she got the Vulcan just down pat. It was just terrific. I felt that way. I felt that way about just about everybody. I thought that the young actor who played Khan's second in command, good looking, tall, blonde guy, I thought he was going to be a movie star. I figured this guy had it, you know, in every way. I never really heard too much about him. Maybe he retired or something, but I just thought everybody was right on target. And there was a moment that DeForest had. What was it? McCoy, get back your command. Oh, that was one moment. That was fun when Spock says good luck to Captain Kirk, and Dr. McCoy says, "Thank you." He wasn't included.
Yeah.
I mean, those kind of little moments are so, they make, you know, you can't, they make the whole, they make the whole movie come together. And you see, it's not two-dimensional. It's fully developed all the way around.
Yeah, a lot of little moments like that.
I like that.
Yeah. Let's take a quick little break, everybody. And then we're going to get into deeper into Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. We'll be right back on The Seventh Rule. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Seventh Rule with Sirach Lofton and Walter Koenig. We're doing a very special review of The Wrath of Khan. Here are the trivioids of the week. Starship Enterprise is on a training mission to Gamma Hydra. Kirk advises prayer that Klingons don't take captives. Khan remembers Chekhov. That's a point of contention among Star Trek fans, too. Kirk took the Kobayashi Maru three times. Lieutenant Savick likes to quote regulations. Bones only uses Romulan ale for medicinal purposes. Kirk is allergic to retinax. Carol Marcus has a secret. And Kirk is the only cadet ever to beat the no-win situation. All right. Actually, let's start with that, Walter. You know, I don't know if you know this, but Star Trek fans like to argue amongst themselves sometimes. It sounds surprising, but they do. So, okay.
They have what?
They tend to argue amongst themselves about certain things, like what's canon or what's not canon or what happened or who's what. One of the points of contention was Khan says, "I remember your face." And they all say, "Well, now hang on a second. Walter, Chekhov was not in the first season of the original series when Khan's episode happened. How is this possible?" And others said, "Well, he could have been stationed on the Enterprise in the first season and we just didn't see him. You know, he could have been there, but he just wasn't on the bridge. Maybe he was just, you know, working in the halls, fixing stuff." Any thoughts on that, Walter?
How could I not have thoughts? I mean, people take great pride in telling me time and again that that was a contradiction. And the fact of the matter is, as I've mentioned on previous podcasts, I read the script before we ever went into production. I was asked to read it by Mr. Bennett, and obviously I noticed that immediately. Mm-hmm. And discretion being the better part of valor, I chose not to mention to anybody that Chekhov wasn't in Space Seed. It was conceivable to me that if I had mentioned it, somebody might say, "Oh, well, in that case, we'll have Sulu play opposite Khan." I wasn't ready for that. I mean, this was juicy. For me, it was a juicy role, a plum opportunity. I'm curious as to why at this juncture they gave me that much to do when I hadn't really proven in any other iteration of Star Trek that I was involved in that I was capable of bringing something additional to the part. I didn't know Nick before we started shooting. I didn't know Harve Bennett, even though Bennett, you know, was the producer on the first film, I think. Yeah. And I think maybe he wasn't. In any case, I was really, really pleased that they gave me that much. And I just rejoiced in the opportunity to make a contribution. It's one thing to be a part of the group, and you know, and you're hanging on by somebody's coattails, and quite another to actually feel that you're involved in the story and in the process, and that your character means something to the story. So I really loved being in this movie and working with Ricardo Montalban and everybody. I, you know, it's It's curious. I'm all over the place, but God knows at my age, if I don't say it when I'm thinking it, I fly away and I'll never remember it again. We had one very, very intense, hostile moment between Bill and I. And that's when they discover us on the space station. We're all, you know, in little boxes. And we were getting ready to transport out of there. And in fact, there was a comment about where's the transporter. So we lined up on the transporter, and I lined up, and I was told to stand behind Bill. Chekhov said behind Captain Kirk, and I did. It was too deep, you know, for the six of us, and, or I think that's how many. In any case, Bill looked and saw me behind him, and he said, move a little bit further. Didn't want me behind where I could be seen.
That's Bill.
Yeah, that's exactly Bill. And I said, no, this is where Nick told me to stand. And he says, no, stand a little further. And I said, no, this is what you do, Bill. And he says, I wouldn't do that. I wouldn't do that. That's neurotic. That's what he said to me. That's neurotic. And then he looked at me like I did a double take to make me shrink, you know, to okay. When I looked at it last night, we weren't too deep. We were in a single line. How did that happen? I mean, I remember specific, I went home, my gut was churning. I was so angry. And I didn't know at that point that anybody else felt the same way about his occasional behavior. But then to watch it, and it wasn't, somehow it was changed from I standing behind him to the six of us given equal exposure in front of the camera. Yeah. So that was curious. I found that very curious.
Yeah, so I guess that's a small example of the kind of frustrations that you had when you were working with Bill, kind of being directed by him in certain instances or told things or intimidated. So, and I can see that. But I can also see how that same thing that is a behavioral thing of his could also play well into the character of Kirk. So,
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It's like this thing that he has, this ego or whatever it is, also plays well for Kirk, and on screen, it works well, and so it's actually a minus becomes a plus when it comes to the character of Kirk. I think that's ironic.
I hasten to add though, that as big as Ricardo Montalban was on camera, I mean, he just overwhelmed at the screen. When they said cut, he was a human being, a good guy, a gentleman. He kissed the ladies' hands. He knew when to turn it off. And so, although explain Mr. Shatner's involvement that perhaps ran beyond the film rolling, it is possible to be a big star, a strong actor, and somebody of great merit and ability, and then when they turn the camera off, to be a human being, to be a nice guy, to be somebody that everybody likes, you know. And he wasn't trying to be nice. It was just who he was. It was delightful. It was truly delightful.
It's like that old quote, have you ever tried acting? You don't have to like be that character. You can just act like that character. But did you have more to that, Sirach?
No. I mean, that was a big thing. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the wardrobe and the sets, if you had any comments on those, because the jump for me mentally from reviewing this series to now watching this movie, it feels like, you know, like there's a big gap there from, you know, the set design, the wardrobe, you know, even the age of the characters. Like everybody seemed older to me, you know, Michelle Nichols, everybody was a little bit older. It's been,
10 years.
you know, right. So, any thoughts on, you know, set design, the wardrobe, or those kinds of things?
Well, that's interesting. I don't know what the term is. It's vanishing perspective. That's not the word. Vanishing something where you're trying to, you want to give the illusion of the set being deeper than it is. You know, when we went into the engine room, we used that concept of a vanishing. I don't know what
Vanishing
the other word.
point? Is it vanishing point?
No, well, it's sort of self-explanatory, but
Yeah.
neither of those is the right word. In any case, we wanted the engine room to look much deeper than it was, and they did a very interesting thing. Not only did they draw lines in or in the set, but the things in the foreground were bigger than the same things when they were in the background, so that you got the sense that you were going further away. And they went so far as to bring in people to stand in those places that were taller in the foreground and were shorter in the background. So I mean, they were literally shorter. I think we had a little person in the far end of the set. We did that kind of magical trick where, you know, the set is only this long, but it becomes that long because you're using smaller people, smaller set pieces.
Yeah.
And I thought it was a terrific idea. I loved it. It seemed kind of obvious in retrospect, but at the time it seemed just perfect.
I gotta look for that. I did that kind of went by me. I did see how long some of those caverns were, those engine rooms. I did notice the depth, but I didn't notice the smaller sets being designed and the people being, you know, arranged in a certain way. So that's something to look for. But you know, this is the other thing that struck me, Walter, was how big of a role that you played in this movie. I know I'm saying it over again, but for me, again, jumping from the series to now watching this movie, it seemed as though outside of Kirk, Spock, and maybe Dr. McCoy, it seemed like you were the lead, you know, the third biggest lead on this movie,
Wow.
from the Star Trek cast.
Well,
So
that's
you
crazy.
had more to do than Montgomery Scott. You had more to do than Nichelle. You had more to do than T'Kay.
Yeah, it's like he
So,
was the lead of the B plot, basically, right? You know, I mean, and then they converge and it becomes all one big story.
That's what I saw. So
Yeah.
I was surprised to see how much your role had grown and how much faith they put in you to carry this movie, essentially, which now has been inducted into the National Archives. So clearly you've done your job as far as, you know, carrying your load. But anything, so you mentioned that too when you talked about reading the script and seeing how much they had to do, and you didn't want to make any comments that might that caused you to get your scenes cut, you know. But I thought you did a fantastic job. And I was surprised to see so much, to see you do so much. I was happily surprised.
Well, you know, Sirach, we're actors and we have egos, you know, and that's part of the reason why we're actors. We want to be appreciated. We want to be respected for what we do. And frequently, and I'm only at this moment speaking for myself, but I think it generalizes to the entire profession. you think you can do, you always think you can to do at least what they've given you and more than what they've given you. You know, that's the perspective, that's the mental exercise that you're going through. Well, I certainly can do this and more if they give me the shot. So although it was nice at the time, I thought it was justified. I thought, okay, this is, you know, in Star Trek One, I screamed once, and that was pretty much it. And Star Trek Two, my part is getting better. And so it was only in rewatching it that I realized that that was pretty unusual. It was pretty much a giant step for me in the role of Chekhov to have that significant part. And that is, as I might have mentioned, I think I might have mentioned, caused the rift that occurred when we were getting ready to do Star Trek III, because I certainly thought that after two, I couldn't go anywhere but up, and Star Trek III was back down again. And I got into a fight with Mr. Bennett. I complained that the role was not as good as the one that had been in Star Trek II. They gave me a take it or leave it offer to do the role. And I said, I leave it. And I told my family that I was not going to be in Star Trek III. And the next day they called back with another offer, which is also part of the biz, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't expect that. I really thought I was done. But that's part of the biz when they tell you something and then it turns out not to be true. You know, it was a bluff. I didn't realize, to tell you the truth, I didn't realize that the fan base was so strong that they really supported the secondary characters as passionately as they did. Mm-hmm. Scotty, Uhura, Sulu, Chekhov. That we were in their minds, you know, as important, well, not as important, but important to the whole concept of Star Trek as it turned out they felt that we were. So when they told me take it or leave it, and I said leave it, I really thought I was done. I didn't think there was going to be any question about it. So that's an interesting perspective. And Bill was right. I'm going way afield here, but we have to excuse the fact that I'm 88 years freaking old. Bill's at one point, when he was really feeling the heat about our criticisms, said for public pronouncement that these people would never have dared, these people being George, Michelle, Jimmy, and I, to be so aggressive had they not gotten the support of the fans. We'd go to conventions and they really loved all these supporting characters. I was certainly very surprised. I knew what I had contributed, and aside from, you know, a couple of opportunities that I had in two and four, it was pretty much a marginal character as my consideration. And to be so embraced as were George, Nichelle, and Jimmy, that it was a big surprise. And we did feel our oats a little bit. We felt, well, okay, if that's the case, if the fans really want us to be involved and they consider us part of the family, and not simply not part of the triumvirate that they had that were featured in every episode and film, then certainly we have a right to speak out a little bit. And Bill saw that as a negative, you know, that we were getting too big for our britches, and we thought it was justified in terms of the support that we were receiving from fans all over the country and eventually all over the world. So that was that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really that's a lot you covered there. One is the ability to and willingness to walk away is always your biggest bargaining chip in a negotiation. And whether you realize it or not, when you walked away, you had the upper hand because you had the willingness to walk away, and they really did not have that ability. They bluffed it, but they had to come back to you. And another thing is, yeah, the fans loved you guys. They love all the Star Trek characters always. And you guys had won their hearts over, and there would have been riots if there was no Chekhov in the next movie. I wanted to touch a little bit more about Ricardo Montalban because we talked about in the first segment, but I felt the same way where, like, I'm watching this and I'm thinking, man, this guy's really acting big. You know, some would say overacting or just doing too much. And, you know, in your mind, you think, oh, this line could have been delivered this way. Or if I had read this line, I would have delivered it more something like this or this word, you know. And I find myself trying to replay his line readings, the way he read certain lines. And I'm like, I just would not have the balls to do it that big. It just would feel fake if I'm trying to go that big or that extreme or that dramatic. Yet, watching him on screen, it worked. It was believable. There was not one drop in his eyes that says, I don't believe what I'm performing here. And I think it was just that he fully committed, he fully believed, and no matter how big he went, it worked. We totally believed it. So I don't know, Siroc, if you felt the same way or if you caught any moments where you're like, ah, rein it in, bro, a little too much.
No, I thought it was adequate and actually appropriate. The other thing I was thinking about watching the scene was opposite Walter. Walter is putting on a Russian accent for his character, but I believe Montalban's accent is his authentic
Yeah,
accent, if I'm
it
not
was.
mistaken, Walter, right? Is that and
Right.
I think that's what enhances his performances. The accent itself resonates with me when I
Yes,
watch the performance.
acting
Absolutely.
was beautiful. It was amazing. It was one of the best performances I've ever seen.
Yeah, absolutely. That was all him. Yeah. The performance becomes like part of his costume. And I mean that's another dimension to this character. That's another way of defining this character, but by his performance. It didn't feel phony. It just felt this is who this man is, and you identify him. And when you identify him, that's part of who he is. The performance, certainly the accent, but the color of that performance was just so exciting.
I wanted to give a
And
very.
when he gets the quote Shakespeare,
Yeah,
it's so perfect. It's just him. Somebody else it might feel like they were reciting, lines from somewhere else, but
I
that was just him,
wanted to give a quick shout out to Transporter Chief Kyle. Siroc, you remember in
Yeah,
our
I was going
episodes?
to bring
Yeah,
that up.
I was like, wait a second. When they said
Yeah.
Commander Kyle, I was like, that's the guy. That's the transporter chief. And
Yeah.
so I thought it was so cool that like Chekhov and Kyle both had gone over to the Reliant. We love Star Trek fans love to see familiar faces, and we love to see where are they now. And he had a promotion. You know, he went over to a new ship with you. I thought that was just really cool. It was a very welcome sight.
When I was watching it, and I just if you'd asked me who was on the Reliant, I would not have mentioned him because I didn't even remember him. But watching it, I said, well, I guess they felt if Chekhov can have a promotion or a transfer without his payment, then why not bring Kyle along? So I thought that was kind of interesting, kind of fun. And I'm glad they did it. They just want to get as many recognizable faces as they could, and that's the, I think that's to the credit of the company, of the production. You know, there was a certain loyalty there, and a certain acknowledgement that the fans would enjoy seeing people from the series, and he was from the series, so. Yeah, I enjoyed that. I thought it was a good idea. Didn't understand it. I mean, we don't want to explain why Chekhov is there, do we?
He got a promotion. I mean, yeah. That's what happens. He did a great job for those 10 years. And then, you know, he kept moving up in the ranks. Everybody did. Uhura was promoted. Spock was now a captain. Kirk was now an admiral. Everybody, you know, kind of moved up in the world, except for Bones. I think Bones was still just chilling. He's like, I'm just a doctor. Relax. Right. You
know? I'm a doctor, not an admiral.
Yeah. Well, we're just about out of time here. And Walter, if you see anything in your notes you want to throw in before we go, please feel free. Otherwise, while we're waiting for that, it is time for the seventh rule home run of the episode. Home run of the, well... movie. This is going to be a tough one. Walter Koenig, who gets the home run of this huge box office smash?
Well, has anybody ever done a double?
Yeah, we have back-to-back home runs. We got solo home runs, grand slams, you name it. Well, you could hit for a cycle.
I would say Khan and Kirk, the double Ks. Khan was magnificent. I thought Bill was, regardless of my personal difficulty with him, I thought he was terrific. There's so much subtlety in what he did, and so much authority and command. So I give them double home runs.
Mm-hmm. They're like Will Clark and Kevin Mitchell. Right, Mark McGuire and whoever else. Anyway, what about you, Ciroc? Back-to-back home runs, who gets the home run of the episode or movie?
Yeah, I'm going to have to agree with Walter on that. It's, you know, Khan, he gives us a great villain, one of the all-time great villains of Star Trek in this movie. And then Kirk does his usual thing of just, you know, being a leading man. And you can see why Mr. Shatner has been a leading man for, you know, decades at this point in this movie. He has a real good command of scenes. His presence is there. And he just oozes leading man. It's just he can't help it, and I think he's fantastic at it in this particular movie. I love the chemistry with the ongoing chemistry with him and Leonard Nimoy, and also DeForest Kelly. I thought played a lot of comical notes that I enjoyed as well. But yeah, and the other the invisible home run for me also goes to. Nicholas Meyer and some of the shots that he took on this. I just enjoyed, he really captured the bigness of the ship. I felt like the Enterprise, I had seen it in a way that I hadn't seen it before. Some of those exterior ship shots just looked so beautiful. So yeah, Nicholas Meyer as a director, I thought also carried his weight.
Mm-hmm. I'm on the same page as you, Ciroc. I thought, you know, it begins with a great script. It's just flat out a very good script. And you'd be hard pressed to not, you know, make this a great movie based on that great script. But above all, beyond that, I did think the directing, again, like you said, captured the bigness of it. I mean, I did not feel like I was watching Star Trek. I felt like I was watching a Star Trek big screen movie production. Like it felt big, it felt huge, it felt like an event. It made me just feel like a fan, a child, somebody giggling in their seat, eating their popcorn with my friends. Like, this is it. This is the moment. Let's just sit back and really, I mean, it just was this big, beautiful, incredible production. And I think that's Nicholas Meyer all over the place. And secondarily, I thought that Ricardo and his performance were jaw-dropping. And that's why it's so memorable. This is why everybody keeps talking about Khan forever and ever and ever and ever. It's because of that performance. And so huge home runs for those guys. All right. Home runs also belong to some of our friends. Let's pull them up here. Their names are Dr. Anne-Marie Seagull, Eve England out in Wales, Yvette Blackman, Tom TJ, Jackson Bay out in Missouri for some reason, Titus Muller, Dr. Muhammad Noor, Anil O. Palat, Joe Balsarati, Mike Gu, Dr. Stephanie Baker, Carrie Schwent, Faith Howell, Edward Foltz, The Matt Boardman, Chris McGee, Justin Weir, Jake Barrett, Henry Unger, Allison Leach Hyde, Julie Manasfi, Jed Thompson, Dr. Susan V. Gruner, Glenn Iverson, Dave Gregory, Chris Sternett, the wine guy, Greg K. Wickstrom out in Hawaii. He sees everything two hours after we do. Cassandra Gerard, Chuck A., and of course, no strangers to this movie, Jason Oaken and Chris Garris. All right, everybody, stick around. We've got the free-for-all up next. We're going to cover this a lot more, hit a lot of perspective. It's going to be a lot of fun. We'll be right back on The Seventh Rule. Hey, everybody, welcome back to The Seventh Rule with Siroc Lofton. This is the free-for-all with Melissa Longo.
Hello there.
Jason M. Oaken.
Hey, everybody.
Chris Garris is out in Texas somewhere.
Hello.
Allison Leach Hyde will counter that with New Mexico. Eve England is like, I beat you all with Wales. Because she's from Wales. Scott Jensen, aka Goldu Scott, is in the house as well. We've got Carrie Schwent, aka Crafty Bear. Chuck A, the TNG fanatic, is hanging out with us. Faith Howell is got the beautiful Golden Gate Bridge behind her, and Chris McGee will be the Dark Lord of the episode. All right, Jake Sisko guesses the IMDb score of this movie. Ooh. This is your first movie guess.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wow. I'm going to say it was an 88. Mm-hmm. 8.8.
To match Walter's age, and also has got a little bit of a Back to the Future homage there. Anybody else have any guesses?
Yeah, I think it would be high 80s, yeah. 8.9, maybe, if not higher.
9.1.
There are a few of us that know what the actual IMDb score is that are going like, yeah, what's up with that IMDb score? 7.7. That's like George Mirasan style. What the heck?
Well, I got the double number right.
Did? All right. Did we get any non-appearance mentions? That's a tough one. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Got
it. Sarek.
That's Sarek, right? Yeah.
Sarek.
Oh, good.
Sarek. And the original father.
Every time I hear his name, of course, I think of mine. So I always notice those names.
What do you got for us, Chris McGee?
There was also Khan's wife, he mentioned, which we saw in Space Seed.
Oh, yeah.
Very true. Very good.
Marla McGivers.
Mm-hmm. Marla McGivers.
And lastly, Chris McGee, I hope you got some of these for us. Any some kinds of or some sorts of? Feels like this kind of movie would have like two or three of them.
It only had one, though. When discussing the situation with her team, Carol Marcus says, "We must have order here. There has to be some sort of mistake."
Ooh. Mm-hmm. All right, Melissa Longo, you know the rules. Please get us started off on the right track by telling us, first of all, if you've seen this movie before, and secondly, what you thought of it.
Yes, I had seen this movie before. It was my first Star Trek. when I was a wee little munchkin, And I was too young to see it in the movies, but I saw it on television. And the night after I saw it on television, I slept with toilet paper in my ears because I didn't want the thingies to get in my ears. So it was a little traumatizing back then. I watched it a second time, maybe a year or so ago, and I wasn't that impressed. But watching it a third time, I realized why I wasn't that impressed the second time is because my attention span has gotten much shorter nowadays because of technology. And this third time, I actually was able to pay attention, and I enjoyed it a lot more. The music, firstly, had me at hello. James Horner was fantastic in creating the music for this. Visually, for the time, it was really quite stunning. The costumes, I love the costumes. And the sets, like Kirk's quarters and other things. But yeah, it was pretty great. And then I have to say that doesn't matter what William Shatner or Leonard Nimoy's relationship was off screen, on screen, they had such great chemistry. They had wonderful chemistry. And it's a friendship that I believe that has evolved over time. Kind of like this movie, their friendship matured. And I feel like Star Trek matured with this movie from the original series. So those are my two cents.
Excellent thoughts. Thank you very much, Melissa Longo. Jason M. Oaken, I'm going to guess you've seen this movie before, being that before we hit record, Siroc said, what was the budget? And you went, 15, like super quick. Like, I don't know how you can pull that out so quickly, but what did you think of this movie?
Well, I think it is a wonderful film. It is certainly a great Star Trek film, and it's just a wonderful film. It's about friendship. It's about aging. It's about sacrifice. Of course, you know, the viewer benefits from having seen the original series and, you know, kind of falling in love with the characters and seeing them grow and develop and, you know, become sort of more three-dimensional characters on screen. Even though the stakes aren't perhaps, you know, galaxy-destroying stakes, it's kind of, you know, small stakes. You have a kind of a vengeance story, almost a Moby Dick type story. But that's what actually makes it so special. You sort of feel this with the characters to go on a journey, and it's a wonderful film to experience. I think it's wonderfully directed, both visually and also, frankly, the performances that Nick Meyer got out of everybody were great. And that is not an easy thing to do, especially on a budget like this and on a tight schedule. And, you know, the film was shot under the auspices of the television division of Paramount, which would operate a little bit differently than you would have in a major motion picture with the studio and everything else. So I think what came out of it was great. You know, the score is tremendous, and there's a story behind the score as well. But it certainly 2 hours that take you away and take you on a journey. It's a wonderful film.
Is it your favorite?
It's one of them, yes.
Good enough. Thanks very much, Jason M. Oaken. All right, Chris Garris out in Texas. What do Texans think of this movie?
It's great. It's the best. So so it's actually, this is one of my top three movies of the TOS era. I'm not going to say it's one or three, but it's definitely in there with Star Trek IV and Star Trek VI. Those are, you know, my biggest ones. And of course, you know, I watched it years ago. I just saw it as an action movie, but it really does deal with revenge, friendship, and sacrifice as one aspect. But also, sadly, it also deals with the fact that, once again, you have a device, a tool that is to be used, that can be used for good, but also can be very easily used for evil and destruction, the whole Genesis device. You know, and, you know, as it progresses, we learn how, you know, almost a Picard, but Kirk is not happy with his choices as becoming an admiral, because now he's got a desk job. He's not in the middle of all the action and fighting and all that. So he's honestly just kind of sourpuss in a way. You know, his birthday's coming up, and you know, Bones has to bring him, you know, some Romulan ale to kind of cheer him up, along with glasses, and you know, remind him that hey, he is getting old. But he also points out the fact that he left the Enterprise and he should have never done that. And, you know, I know we're kind of keeping these a little bit shorter today, but, you know, it wasn't until, so like I said, I only watched it when it was on TV and whatnot. I'd never seen Space Seed. So I didn't really understand the whole, you know, backstory of Khan. And it really wasn't until just a couple of years ago, I actually did take the time and gave in and watched Space Seed, which made this a lot. It ties things up to make understand a little more why Khan was so just irritated with Kirk. And so it helped me to understand it better. And of course, I mean, it's one of, for me personally, in Star Trek, has some of this, one of the saddest, you know, scenes there at the very end. And, you know, I held it together for a while, but then when they start playing those bagpipes, done. Waterworks. That's it. And even still to this day, and which is crazy, they can do that. You know, and it has some other, you know, it has some humor and stuff that we didn't, you know, that has been, due to the 2009 movies, they explain a little bit more about how Kirk actually did pass his test and everything. But overall, for me, it's one of the best, you know, of the original era. So yeah, there's some little questions I've always had, which we can talk about in the next segment, that just didn't make sense it just didn't make sense because of the way things happen. So, but I'll leave that for later on. But overall, it's hands down one of the best episodes. I'm sorry, movies.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Thank you very much, Chris Garris. All right. Allison Leach Hyde knows what's coming. She just unmuted herself before I even said her name. What's up? What did you think of this one? Was it your first?
This was probably my first Star Trek movie. Yes, it is a couple years older than me. So it would have been hitting TV when I was little. And I am pretty sure this is the first one I ever saw. So I didn't know, you know, I'm three. Two, three, like literally my entire life, I have watched this movie. And I didn't see Space Seed until I was much older. So for me, that's how, when he's like, when in Space Seed, when Khan comes out, I'm like, oh, this is how it ties together. So I went about it backwards too. But it's just, Khan has been, you know, Khan has been in my life for as long as I can remember. So yes, I love this movie. I love everyone's snarky sense of humor. I use it too much. We all know where it came from. Between my mom, my dad, and Star Trek, I got a snarky sense of humor. So I think it's a funny thing to say. I have always loved this movie. It is a ton of fun. And the costumes are great. I want the Monster Maroon away jacket. So much. I love Kirstie Alley in this movie. When we're in the beginning and we've got the Kobayashi Maru going, and of course we don't know it's a simulation yet. And then when she whips around in her chair, you're like, oh, that's not what I expect. I love that. I think that's a great, you know, visual gag of we're getting something a little not what we expect. And I think that's great because, you know, we have had these characters for 20, 25 years, like for a really long time. So throwing us a little bit of a loop is great. And everyone, you know, kind of like poking at Kirk about his birthday and him just being the biggest sourpuss ever about it is, it's funny to me. Because he's done so many, you know, like big grand adventure things. Like you would think like, yeah, it's my birthday. I've survived. This is awesome. But we're not there yet until the end, which I think is beautiful. And it's a wonderful arc for Kirk. Giving him more depth and more arc and more appreciation for life is wonderful. And I really, really enjoy that. It's a beautiful film to watch. The nebula is gorgeous. It's so gorgeous. They reuse it a lot in Next Generation. They just recolor it. So I get why they would. It is beautiful. So yeah, I had one little nitpick, and that's when Carol Marcus and Kirk are talking about him staying away. and Chekhov is laying there through the whole thing, holding his ear. Like, are you just trying to be quiet? Because you can't hold your ear if you're unconscious. So he's just laying there listening to this exceptionally private conversation. That's always been my one nitpick about this entire movie. I'm like, why didn't you send him off to go get an apple in the cave too? So, but I love this movie. I got to see it in theaters a couple years ago, and it is so great on the big screen.
Nice. Thank you very much, Allison Leach. Hi, this is the one movie where keeping your ears open is a bad thing. Eve England is out in Wales. What did you think of this movie? And was this your first time seeing it?
I think I have seen it. I have definitely seen it when I was young, but you know, I couldn't really remember much about it. So it was quite a fun experience just to sort of catch all of the now famous memes and actually just sort of, because 2009 is my favorite movie, to actually see how much of this movie was actually in the 2009 movie, including my all-time favorite quote, which is, "Are you out of your Vulcan mind?" And I thought that was a new thing. So I was like, oh my gosh. So I thought that was really cool. So that was a big sort of laugh moment to me. But I have to say that given all the hype that I know that this film has, I was kind of surprised by how slow-paced it was. And although we had pockets of, you know, lots of action, it was generally, you know, felt like a sort of character story, as everyone said, it's about camaraderie and growing old and all of those sort of interesting sort of human stories. But I was also shocked by how different it felt to the original series. So it just felt very rageful, so very violent, I think, at times, and they kill off one of the main characters, and obviously now we know that it kind of doesn't end like that. I can only imagine how shocking that must have been for audiences at the time, who were just so used to this sort of resetting episodic sort of nature of Star Trek that they'd seen. So I thought that was just this thinking back to, you know, if I was watching it when it came out, I think that must have been quite shocking for people. So I thought that was quite interesting. And I did really like the sort of how they sort of pit sort of Khan against Kirk in terms of, you know, had Kirk with that, as Alison just said, about that sort of arc about him dealing with aging. And then you have Khan, who just doesn't have that problem at all. And I just thought that was a sort of really interesting dynamic throughout that sort of gave it that sort of edginess. I haven't seen the original episode, so I don't really know the background, but I thought that was a clever way, even without knowing the background, about these sort of two completely different characters and how it all resolves itself at the end. So there were lots of things that I really enjoyed, but I think generally it just felt a bit too long. But maybe, as Melissa said, maybe that's just because my attention span is reduced. But as everyone else said, the scenery was amazing. Visually, I thought it was absolutely beautiful. Costume sets, music. And I can just imagine that everybody loved it at the time. So it was quite interesting to sort of watch it from that lens and appreciate it for that.
Mm-hmm. Attention span is reduced. What a nice way of putting it. Thank you very much, Eve England out in Wales. Carrie Schwent, a.k.a. Crafty Bear. She's got a good attention span. What'd you think of this one?
I like it more. I've only actually seen it prior to joining the Seventh World, I think once before. So this was sort of my second time watching it. And after having done like the reviews of the other TOS episodes that we have so far, I find I like it more the second time than I did the first time. Really enjoy it. Love Ricardo Montalban. He is charm personified. His nickname over the years as in acting was, he was the Latin lover. You can totally see that charisma just jumping off of him. And I've got a longer than usual poem, so I'll save a couple things that I uncovered for later. But among the many, 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 many trivia bits on IMDb, one that stood out to me that just amused me was apparently some of the extras on Khan's crew were active Chippendale dancers. I love that so much. I do, yeah. And also, in a slightly related note, Khan's chest, all natural. He was an strict diet. He worked out a ton. There, I guess there were rumors going around that it was like prosthetics enhanced. No prosthetics needed there. Where was the other thing? Oh yeah, I have several guest stars that I'll gush over if we have time and things left unsaid. But one I will bring up because it is related to our Seventh Rule reviews. The actor who plays Kirk's son was what played T'Jaan in the season one TNG episode Symbiosis. And I thought watching Khan that he looked familiar. And then when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, that's why he seemed so familiar. And love the curls in his hair in Khan. I dig that style of hair from back then. Yeah. Do have one or two other things for things left unsaid, but for the poetry for this time around, being because it was Khan, I couldn't go just, you know, a short haiku or a silly limerick. In honor of King Lear that you see on the bookshelf, I decided to go with a sonnet. So it is a little bit longer, so if you will indulge me. Okay. I find myself musing about the past, this place, the trials, the tribulations. It has been very long and yet so fast. In that time, I've made some observations. 10 and 5 number the years that have passed. Images of you have stayed in my brain. You should have killed me when you had the chance, but now I owe you a great deal of pain. My beloved wife, I've lost to this place. If she knew what I had in mind to do, I wonder what she would have had to say. Would she stop me or tell me to pursue? With all the hate that lies deep in my heart, I would see your whole world torn apart.
Thank you. Excellent work. Thank you very much, Kerry Schwent, a.k.a. Crafty Bear. All right. Chuck A., the TNG fanatic. You also like original series, probably. What'd you think of this one?
Well, it's this movie is the first movie after the motion picture, obviously, and they made great improvements on action and story. It didn't run as slow. I did see Space Seed when it first aired, and having Ricardo Montalban come back as Khan was wonderful. Such a dynamic actor. I'm going to expand on what Kerry Schwent just said, that Khan's right-hand man was Joachim, and that was played by Judson Scott. He didn't ask for his name in the credits, but he was also in Symbiosis with Merritt Bruttrick in the same episode. So they had two Wrath of Khan actors in the same Next Gen episode. And also, I don't know if you got Walter's comments at all, but when Khan says, "I know you, Chekhov," Chekhov wasn't in the first season when Space Seed was out. So I don't know how they wound up explaining that. I think I remember hearing Walter joke about it, but I don't remember what he said. The also thing is the last scene that went into Star Trek III, you know, the planet scene, and you have Leonard Nimoy doing the voiceover of Space, the Final Frontier. I thought that was a cool thing, mm-hmm. instead of having Shatner do it. My top three movies, as like what Chris said, was Wrath of Khan, Voyage Home, and The Undiscovered Country. To me, they're all equally good movies. It's hard to choose which one I like the best, but this movie was really a fantastic movie.
Mm-hmm. Great knowledge. Excellent knowledge, Chuck A. All right, Faith Howell, you are up next. What did you think of this episode? Sorry, we keep saying that. Movie.
Oh. As some of you guys have mentioned already, I was quite young when I first saw this. Now, I was actively watching every Saturday the original series because that was the Trek of the time in my daddy's lap. So I don't know for sure whether I saw this or Space Seed first, probably concurrently back and forth before I was even old enough to truly remember. But I can say that this is my factually least favorite of all Trek episodes, movies. Now,
What?
I did rewatch it. It is fabulous. I will give it that. The acting is great, as you guys have said, the music, the costuming, the casting was it was fascinating. I mean, it's a joy to watch, all except for that one part with the ear thing. That ruined my life. And anytime it has been played in the house since then, I will actively leave the room because I cannot. So I did watch it today. I was driving, so I wasn't looking at the screen, but I did watch the second half when I got home, and it is beautiful. And I mean, what's not to love? They're all of our characters that we've loved on television together again for an adventure. They have the heartbreak at the end, which of course, some of us are maybe not old enough to have remembered that heartbreak, and we already knew the aftermath before we really felt the sting. But I just love those iconic scenes and getting to see our characters together again. So it was definitely fun to watch today, but I definitely will probably fast forward through that first part.
All right, Faith, if it weren't for the ear thing, where would it rank in the 13 movies?
I'd have to do a rewatch of all of them and recompare.
All right, everybody, tune in next week. Thank you very much. They howl by the Golden Gate Bridge. All right, Chris McGee, the Dark Lord. What do you got for us today, Chris McGee?
Well, what could I possibly add to what has already been said about what I think is one of the greatest sci-fi films of all time? I honestly feel like anything I say would be inadequate. Nevertheless, here we go. First, of course, I agree with everyone else's point, so there's no need for me to repeat them. As Melissa said, I like the uniforms. I love that they were redesigned from the ones in the show and in the motion picture, looking more like something a naval officer of the future would wear. Instead of having fully colorful tops to indicate their department, all the uniforms are pretty much identical. The department or section is indicated by the color of the undershirt and the rank insignia on the shoulder. In this way, they're kind of similar to Deep Space Nine's later gray uniforms, which I vastly prefer. Of course, the legendary Kobayashi Maru training's first scene in this film has been mentioned, which has been referenced in so many other movies and episodes that it's now become a part of pop culture, even beyond Star Trek fandom, I think. Whenever someone mentions an impossible task, they might refer to it as their Kobayashi Maru. Star Trek feature films seem to have a history, in my opinion, of including at least one scene that is disturbing or maybe even nightmare-inducing. In the motion picture, it was the brief transporter accident. Here in this film, as others have said, it's that baby SETI eel entering Charles and Chekhov's ears. Scarred me for life, just like others here. I appreciate that there's very little recounting of the events of Space Seed in this film. There's just enough told by Chekhov and Khan that the audience doesn't need to have seen the original series episode first, but those that have seen it get the benefit of the full history between Kirk and Khan. And of course, as Chris Garris said, what review of this film would be complete without a mention of the final scenes with Spock in the funeral afterward? I don't care if your heart is made of freeze-dried stone. You're going to need a few tissues at the end of this movie. I'll save any other thoughts and nitpicks for things I've done said for the memorable quote. Man, oh, there are so many excellent quotes from this film that I've memorized over the years and that many others know as well. So I feel I should pick a more introspective quote rather than one of those more popular ones, and that is, how we deal with death is at least as important as how we deal with life.
Excellent. Thank you so much, Dark Lord Chris McGee. All right, Scott Jensen, aka Goldu Scott Radical Shirt. What did you think of this movie? I'm going to guess it's not your first time seeing it.
It is not. I'm also going to go pretty quick because my internet is going absolutely wacky right now. I don't know what is happening. But
well, we hear you great.
I don't remember the first time I actually saw this movie. It's kind of like always been a movie that has existed for me, which I love that. I love that it is something that's always been, you know, tertiary. I've mixed it up at points, you know, when I've come and gone with other films and, you know, what happens when and what happens where. But this time it really hit hard. It hit from a different space when I started doing math and I realized how close I am to Kurt's age in this movie. And I started looking at it from that direction and I'm like, holy shit. Yeah. And then because I was like, okay, how old is Shatner now? When did this come? Oh my God. Yeah. Kirk's probably the same age as Shatner. So, oh God, that's me in like 3 years. But yeah, I'm so watching the whole math? Thing. And it, yeah. And that, yeah. Yeah. He's about 50, 51 in this movie. So yeah, it was a little bit, a little bracing for me, but, particularly in the end, when all of that does happen, you get that scene in engineering, which is timeless in American cinema and cinema, I think, and in all of science fiction, that scene up against the glass, always have been my friend, that like kicked like a mule this time, which was absolutely surprising, great, and super depressing at once. But to wrap up, not super depressing, is this where the term earworm came from? Because, you know, when you always hear a song that gets stuck in your head, like you get stuck with Smash Mouth for like 3 weeks straight. It's absolutely maddening.
That's right.
Something absolutely like that. Is this where earworm comes from? Because I could only imagine that having an actual baby worm shoved into your ear hole is as bad as having to hear that kind of stuff in your brain over and over for weeks. The internet didn't tell me, so who knows?
As soon as you said Smash Mouth, my first thought was somebody once told me, but they're San Jose's own. Allison loves the song. Thank you very much, Scott Jensen, a.k.a. Goldie Scott. Siroc, it's time for Jake's final take. Any final thoughts on this movie or Smash Mouth?
Yeah. No Smash Mouth. Well, first I want to clear the air, make sure that everybody knows I'm not wearing chest prosthetics. So just to clarify.
Okay.
Yeah, just to clarify. One thing that jumped out at me in this movie that I didn't know before, and it just came as a shock, and that was that Kirk had a kid named David that's basically in this episode, who he's basically never seen, doesn't raise. And then I thought, that's exactly what they did with Picard,
right?
Yeah,
as a kid that he's never seen, that he didn't raise, that just pops up out of nowhere after he's already an adult. So makes me love Cisco just that much more after I nice. Watch this. The best space dad in the around. So that's one thing jumps out at me. Where can I get this Klingon aphrodisiac that they were talking about? And what is it? Because it seemed like Kirk was on it. He wanted some of that. He's a little disappointed with the Romulan ales. I saw a janitor on Star Trek. It's the first time I saw a guy mopping up the floors. Did you see that? Yeah. I've never seen this before. Where are these guys that are sweeping stuff up? Like, they've never showed them before.
It's the lower
I've
decks.
I've never seen him on Deep Space Nine. And we had carpets, so I know they had to vacuum something or something, or a Roomba. So I thought that was finally cool. Like, let's see somebody else doing something else. And like, basic cleaning up, mopping up stuff is, you know, you would expect that to see that at some point. Somebody wiping down the banisters and breaking out the pledge for all the woodwork. You know, so I was happy to see that. I thought Kirstie Alley was pretty amazing, too. I've always had a slight crush on her, and seeing her in this movie was just that show. and then, you know, it is a slight nitpick, but I wished that there was a little bit more intricate costume design for Khan's Klan. It just didn't have enough for me for a high budget film of this caliber. Those outfits could have been done on any episode, for any regular season episode of any one of the series. It's not really that intricate. It didn't seem that well thought out. I would have liked a theme maybe that went consistent with the climate that we saw them in. Maybe some breathing apparatus or something like that. Mm-hmm. They could have done something a little bit more advanced to up the stakes of the wardrobe for them, because I thought the wardrobe for the Starfleet was amazing, but then it seemed like they got all the budget and Khan's guys didn't get much of the budget for that. So I would have liked to see an improvement there. But other than that, I didn't remember anything in this movie. Only remembered the ear thing. I really dreaded watching that all over again, because it's still burning my brain, and it's taken 30 years for me to go to sleep, you know, without thinking about stuff like that. And now I'm gonna deal with that trauma all over again. But yeah. And you know what? And the other thing is, I see why Khan is one of the best villains in Star Trek. He's just a great actor. But it also made me appreciate watching this, made me appreciate Mark Alaimo and what he did with Gul Dukat as well. Because I think if he had an opportunity to play a feature film villain of Dukat, it would be up there. So, that's up.
Wow, high praise. When Sirach Lofton says this guy's up at the level of Gul Dukat, you know Eve's not going to argue with that. That's some good stuff there. All right. Well, everybody at home, if you are a patron or supporter of The Seventh Rule, then just go ahead and click over to our next segment, The Things Left Unsaid. This is when Faith Howell really unleashes on us. It's crazy. You don't want to miss it. And everybody else, we'll see you next time. Very big special thanks to Scott, Mr. McGee, Faith Howell, Chuck A., Carrie Schwent, Eve England, Allison Leach Hyde, Chris Garrison, Texas, Jason M. Oaken, Melissa Longo for myself, Sirach Lofton, Walter Koenig, Melissa, and Mr. Aaron Eisenberg. We thank you all very much. We will see you next time. And until then, always remember the seventh rule. Hey, everybody, welcome back to the seventh rule with Sirach Frickin' Lofton.
Hello.
This is a magic and unique segment we call the handoff. It's special just for this occasion. We've got Cameron and Jesse of Open Pike Night. What's up, guys? How you doing?
Doing well. Doing well.
Pleasure to be here.
So this is for the pod
for Spock on the mind.
Yes. So, of course, this is all for the National Center for Science Education, put on by our pals at The Greatest Generation. We just finished reviewing The Wrath of Khan with Walter Koenig, who is a ton of fun. You guys are doing Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Can you tell us first, what's up with your show? What do you guys do? Who are you?
So Open Pike Night is the Strange New Worlds podcast where your personal logs are the prime directive. We have folks call in, share their thoughts and feelings on episodes of Strange New Worlds, or, you know, whatever it is we're covering when Strange New Worlds doesn't happen to be on the air. And we like
more
to
often than we'd like.
Yeah. And we like to think of ourselves as a way for folks to skip the convention line. So we've had Melissa Navia, Anson Mount, Christina Chong, basically the entire main cast of Strange New Worlds on the show, taking calls from listeners as a way to connect directly to the audience and things like that. And we met Ben and Adam at Star Trek Las Vegas, not 2024, but 23. And we had a lot of fun. They came to our karaoke night. They made our karaoke night just an absolute blast. And we said, you know, we got to do something in the podcast universe with you guys, because I've been listening to their show for like 6 years at least. And we were just really excited to get something done with them. So we've collaborated with them a few times, but usually we're just a place for anybody to call in and talk to their favorite Star Trek stars. And we're really excited to cover Star Trek 3 because, just a little hint, there may be some TOS alumni in our coverage as well.
What?
It's not Christopher Lloyd. It's not Christopher Lloyd. I'm just going to put that out there right now. Don't get too excited. But there is a really special caller we're excited for people to hear from.
Is it Christopher Ooh. Lloyd?
It's Christopher Lloyd, yeah.
How did you know?
Walter Koenig. Wait, no.
Wow. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, we had a lot of fun talking Search for Spock. That's a fun movie because every time you watch it, there's so much going on in that movie. You get to pull something else from it. And I mean, not to give too much away about our coverage, but you know, there's a lot of highs and lows. So there's a lot to talk about on both ends of the spectrum with that one, I feel like.
Well, that's going to be a lot of fun.
Did you choose this one or was it kind of the luck of the draw? Because there was kind of a luck of the draw on this. Some people wanted certain movies, others wanted other ones, but there's only so many to choose from. Mm-hmm. Was this a good choice for you? Or
we chose Search for Spock and it was available. Yeah, we'd covered a few of the others in one way or another before. So it was down to like Search for Spock and The Voyage Home. We hadn't talked about in a podcast format before. So
okay,
we rolled the dice with three.
Yeah, we had, I think, Strange New Worlds writer Davey Perez stopped by to talk Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country, with us a few months back and how it kind of played into some of the writing that he's done for Strange New Worlds. And we were like, well, our Seventh Rule is doing Wrath of Khan. Like, I want to go talk to Sirach Lofton. How do we get that set up? Plus, you know, we love Search for Spock. I mean, I love Search for Spock. I don't want to speak for my co-hosts, but yeah, we were actually really lucky to get in early on those choices because we knew they were going to fill up fast. So we're very grateful to have Search for Spock and to get to chat with you gents. I mean, Seventh Rule, huge player, right? Like, you guys are a giant show.
Thanks, guys. We're medium. Yeah. But Sirach, actually, when we were choosing them, Sirach actually was like, can we do Star Trek Beyond Burger?
Hey.
We're like, no, it's only the original seven, unfortunately. Maybe next
Maybe
year
next
we'll
year.
Do the next, the next grouping.
Cool. Yeah.
But thanks for the compliments, guys.
Yeah, appreciate you guys.
Well, so that's it, everybody. Please make sure you check out Star Trek III, The Search for Spock with Cameron and Jesse of Open Pike Night. Actually, you guys got a new season coming out in just a few months, right? So that'll be fun.
A lot of excitement. Planning to go to Star Trek Las Vegas.
Great stuff. Thank you all very much for hanging out with us. For myself, Sirach Lofton, Melissa Longo, Aaron Eisenberg. Until next time, always remember the seventh rule.